So these variables include things like whether or not their friends behave in delinquent and antisocial ways, so whether their friends are offending, whether their friends own and carry guns themselves, factors like whether the teens themselves have committed crimes in the past, so what does their offending history look like, also things like what kind of neighborhoods the teens have lived in.
When children show elevated callous and emotional traits, their behavior problems tend to be more severe, more stable, and their aggression tends to be more varied and in a way that leads to more harm to others.
That's Ms. Emily Robertson and Dr. Paul Frick, who will talk about their article on how the presence of callous, unemotional traits affects the risk for gun carrying and gun use during a crime. Their work appears in the September 2020 issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. I'm Michael Roy, executive editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry, and this is AJP Audio. Ms. Emily Robertson is a clinical psychology doctoral student in the Developmental Psychopathology Lab at Louisiana State University. She's interested in the different developmental pathways through which children and adolescents develop serious conduct problems. This fall, she will begin a pre-doctoral internship at the Mailman Center for Child Development in the Miller School of Medicine at the University of Miami. Dr. Paul Frick leads the Developmental Psychopathology Lab at Louisiana State University, and he holds the Roy Crumpler Memorial Chair in the Department of Psychology. Since 2013, Dr. Frick has held a joint appointment in the Institute of Learning Science and Teacher Education at Australian Catholic University in Brisbane. His research has focused on understanding the factors that lead children and adolescents to develop serious emotional and behavioral problems. He's also studied the implications of this research for assessment, treatment, and public policy. Ms. Robertson and Dr. Frick are co-authors of an article in our September issue entitled "Callous Unemotional Traits and Risk of Gun Carrying and Use During Crime." Ms. Robertson, Dr. Frick, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having us.
You begin your article by noting that gun violence is a serious public health concern in the United States. In 2017, there were an estimated 133,000 people who were victims of gun-related violence. The year before that, in 2016, almost one-third of firearm-related homicides were committed by adolescents and young adults ages 12 to 24. So first, could you share your thoughts on why gun violence in this country has become a significant concern among young people?
Absolutely. So youth gun violence is a really complex issue, but one thing we do know is that guns are very available in this country. Estimates suggest that between 25 to 33% of youth have access to guns in the home. So when guns are really available, situations can become lethal really quickly. Thinking about some of the causes of gun violence, at least in terms of individual level risk factors, it's important to know what makes somebody more aggressively and violent in general, but also what makes somebody act in ways that have such a strong likelihood of injury or death, like using a weapon such as a gun. We know there are a whole host of factors that influence whether using a gun is viewed as acceptable. And so for the goal of our study was to see whether callous emotional traits are predictive of gun violence above and beyond what we already know leads to a person to engage in gun violence, or maybe perhaps whether callous emotional traits aren't actually needed to determine that risk for gun violence.
Well, thank you for that background information. And now your article mentions the fact that a new specifier was added within the diagnosis of conduct disorder, which is in DSM-5, and in the diagnosis of conduct dissocial disorder, which is in ICD-11. The exact phrase is "with limited prosocial emotions," and it is meant to designate those with elevated callous unemotional traits. Now, could you define what these traits are and then tell us how common these traits are in the general population?
Yes, in the DSM-5, there are four indicators of the specifier with limited prosocial emotions. They are the callous lack of empathy, a lack of guilt and remorse, a failure to put forth effort into important activities, and a constricted display of affect. In the ICD, they add a fifth symptom of an insensitivity to punishment. Now, how prevalent it is a little more complicated for a number of reasons. As with most traits, callous and emotional traits, there is some normative level in the population. Given that it is a fairly new construct to be used in diagnostic classifications, there has not been a lot of work looking at different ways of making cutoffs for when it becomes abnormal. And It is only used when a child also shows serious behavior problems, that is, has a diagnosis of conduct disorder. So with all that said, what we know at this point is that it typically about 3 to 4% of kids show conduct disorder, and about a quarter to a third of those show elevated callous and emotional traits. So that would all boil down to about 1% of the population that shows significant behavior problems as well as elevated callous and emotional traits.
So it sounds like these kinds of traits are relatively common among young people. So why did you and your co-authors decide to look at the relationship between callous and emotional traits and gun violence in particular?
While some level of these traits are normative, when they reach a certain level, they are typically associated with serious behavior problems and, in particular, serious aggression. That is, when children show elevated callous and emotional traits, their behavior problems tend to be more severe, more stable, and their aggression tends to be more varied and in a way that leads to more harm to others. So because of this, we had the hypothesis that it would be related to gun violence in particular, because gun violence does lead to more harm in others. But when we looked at the literature, this had not been studied yet.
Well, then I'd like to turn now to the methods that you employed in your study. First, how did you and your team go about identifying the study population? And second, what covariates or other variables did you include?
So this study was part of the Crossroads in Juvenile Justice study. This is a multi-site study funded originally by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and then later by the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, the W.D. Grant Foundation, and the Department of Justice. The University of California, Irvine is the coordinating site with Elizabeth Kaufman as the PI. And we also had sites at Temple with Larry Steinberg as PI, and at LSU when I was PI. And the Crossroads study started by looking at kids who were arrested for the first time in either Irvine, California, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, or Jefferson Parish in Louisiana. And we wanted them to be arrested for the first time for offenses of moderate severity, because the overall goal of the study was to determine whether kids who were arrested for the first time did their contact with the juvenile justice system help them later on to be less likely to reoffend, to be less likely to commit crimes, and to be more successful, both in terms of their mental health and educational outcomes, or to be less successful. Now, the reason the sample was a good one to study for gun carrying is, first, we looked at kids who had committed offense of moderate severity and at the time of their first offense. So what this did was, this enhanced the variability in gun carrying. That is, some of these kids are highly likely to commit serious offenses, including gun offenses, whereas others, this may be the only time they ever commit an offense. So it allows us to have a lot of variability in the outcome we were interested in. And a more practical point, this was also a group that was at a good point for intervention, the time of their first arrest. So if we can identify those kids who are at risk for serious offending, such as gun carrying, gun use as a crime, this was a good point at which interventions are possible.
So in terms of the variables that we included, there have been a number of individual and community level risk factors related to gun violence. And so for our study, we wanted to pick the ones that have been the most predictive in past research. And of course, we don't want to oversimplify and suggest that we have captured all of the risk factors for gun violence, but we were able to include quite a few. So these variables include things like whether or not their friends behave in delinquent and antisocial ways, so whether their friends are offending, whether their friends own and carry guns themselves, factors like whether the teens themselves have committed crimes in the past, so what does their offending history look like, also things like what kind of neighborhoods the teens have lived in. We also included other variables that look at how closely their parents monitor their behavior or their daily schedule, and whether the youth had been exposed to violence in the community, both of which have been the subject of much research on youth gun violence over the last decade or so. And we also include other variables like age, race, and IQ as well. And as I mentioned before, we were very interested in whether callous emotional traits tell us anything above and beyond these variables that we already know predict increases in gun violence, or again, perhaps maybe CU traits don't add to that prediction.
Now, you aim to determine whether callous and emotional traits affected a number of variables related to gun violence. These included whether individuals themselves reported that they carried or used a gun, and the relationship with peer gun carrying and gun ownership. How did you identify the specific factors that you looked at?
Well, one of the variables that research has consistently found to be related to youth gun violence is whether their friends carry, own, or use guns themselves. So in general, we know that adolescents are highly susceptible to peer influence or their friends' influence. So we know that teens want to fit in with others and will often engage in risky behaviors in order to fit in, especially if their friends are approving of or actually engaging in those behaviors as well. What's interesting is there's some research showing that teens with elevated CU traits are not as susceptible to their friends' behavior as those with low CU traits. So in other words, teens with elevated CU traits are going to do whatever they want, regardless of what their friends approve of or what their friends do. So we wanted to see if, like other variables related to peer influence, kids with elevated CU traits are less influenced by their friends' gun carrying and gun ownership. So that's really why we wanted to focus on the peer relationships.
Okay, we spent enough time setting the stage. Let's get to the results of your work. Could you tell us what your main hypothesis was and then what you and your team found?
Absolutely. So we had two main hypotheses. First, we predicted that CU traits measured shortly after an adolescent's first arrest would predict the frequency of gun carrying and the likelihood of using a gun during a crime in the subsequent 4 years after that first arrest. And as I mentioned, we wanted to see if this prediction would be above and beyond all the other risk factors that we know already predict gun violence. And we did find support for this first hypothesis. So CU traits do predict how many times a teen carries a gun, and also increases the probability that they'll use a gun during a crime over the four-year period after their first arrest. We also did find that this prediction was above and beyond other known risk factors, such as the neighborhoods that these teens live in, how often their parents monitor their behavior, and exposure to community violence. Our second hypothesis was that CU traits would moderate the relationship between peer gun carrying and gun ownership, and their own gun carrying and gun use in a crime, with the hypothesis being that adolescents who had peers who carried and owned guns would be more likely to carry a gun and use a gun in a crime themselves. But the important part is that we predicted that this would only be true for teens who had normative to low levels of CU traits. In other words, we predicted that those with high levels of CU traits would carry and use guns regardless of whether their friends used guns or owned guns themselves. So overall, this hypothesis was also largely supported. We found that CU traits did moderate that relationship between peer gun carrying and gun ownership status in the prediction of an adolescent's own gun carrying, such that only those low on CU traits carried guns at a higher rate when their friends carried their own guns. Whereas those with high CU traits carried guns more frequently, no matter what their friends did. So this work does seem to support previous research that teens with high CU traits may be less susceptible to their own peers' behavior and influence.
So I'm looking here at table 2 and table 3 of your article, which provides details of how callous unemotional traits, CU traits, interact with a number of covariates and other risk factors to influence the frequency of gun carrying after a first arrest and the status of peer gun carrying and ownership. Could you walk us through what you found relevant here?
Absolutely. So table 2 summarizes the first hypothesis that we talked about. In the top part of table 2, it shows the results of what we conducted a negative binomial regression, which looked at whether CU traits predicted the frequency of gun carrying across a four-year period after controlling for all those other variables that I mentioned. The bottom of the table depicts our first logistic regression analysis that we ran to look at whether callous emotional traits predict the probability that a teen would use a gun in a crime over the subsequent 4 years, again, after controlling for all those other variables. In table 3, we show the interactions between callous emotional traits and peer gun carrying and the prediction of the frequency of gun carrying, as well as the interaction between callous emotional traits, peer gun ownership, and the prediction of the frequency of gun carrying. And as you can see, both CU traits, peer gun carrying, and peer gun ownership all positively predict how frequent a youth carries a gun. In other words, the more elevated a teen is on CU traits, and the more they endorse their peers carrying and own a gun, the more teens themselves would carry guns. However, the significant interaction suggests that this effect was only found in those low on CU traits. So those high on CU traits carried guns no matter how many of their friends owned or carried guns. The last thing I want to point out here is at the bottom of table 3, you can see that the interaction between callous emotional traits and peer gun carrying and peer gun ownership and the prediction of using a gun during a crime did not quite reach statistical significance. So in other words, both callous emotional traits and pure gun carrying and ownership predicted whether or not a teen would use a gun in a crime, but this relationship did not differ at high versus low levels of CU traits.
So based on all this information that you collected and analyses that you run, are there any overall conclusions that you can make?
Yes, two that I'd like to highlight. I think this research supports a lot of other work and work that has become more and more widely accepted, that CU traits are important for designating an important subgroup of youth who show serious behavior problems, whether they're diagnosed with CD, conduct disorder, or whether they're in the juvenile justice system because of their behavior problems. And they designate a subgroup that operates at a high cost to others. What our studies show is that this also includes a very particular type of aggressive behavior, gun carrying, gun use, that before this was not studied. Now, what I think is more novel in terms of something that is not as widely accepted is how callous and emotional traits may moderate, that is, change how other risk factors to aggression and violence, and in our case, gun violence, may be related to that outcome. So again, for us, we show that peer influence can have a very large effect for kids that are low to normative on callous and emotional traits, but has less an effect on kids who are high on callous and emotional traits. And again, while the specifier has been looked at as designating a group that is very severe and operates at a high cost to others, it is less widely accepted or less widely studied in how it can moderate other risk factors.
Are there any limitations that affect the conclusions of your study?
Sure. So the first limitation in our study is that it includes only a male sample. So, this was a good sample to study gun violence because boys are more likely to offend. Research suggests that they have higher levels of aggression. And they also, research also suggests that they own guns at earlier ages. But future research should certainly attempt to replicate these findings in girls or female samples. We also use a sample of juvenile justice involved adolescents. And like Paul mentioned earlier, we did this because we wanted to study a group who was at a high risk of using a gun. And so we wanted a higher base rate because this helps us find significant predictors. However, it does mean that our findings may not generalize to the community samples when the base rate is so much lower for self-reported gun carrying or gun use in a crime. Lastly, we also relied on self-report, which was important because the majority of gun carrying and gun use goes undetected by authorities and is actually often not known by people in a teen's life, like their parents or teachers. But using self-report does lead to an issue called shared method variance between our key predictors and outcomes, which could have inflated the associations. And we do recognize that this method also relies on the youth being honest with us about their behavior. But our study obtained what's called a privacy certificate, which protects the data from being subpoenaed for the use in court. And we explain this to the youth at the beginning of each interview with the idea that it not only protects them, but also sort of encourages honest answering.
Now, I mentioned to you both before we actually started recording how happy I was that the journal was publishing this study because of what I felt was kind of a dearth in our pages and elsewhere regarding research on gun use and gun carrying. So with your study, what would you say the implications are of your work on public policy and on health policy?
What I think are the most important implications are the fact that, and I think this is a very important thing that I want to go back to, is callous and emotional traits, in fact, elevated callous and emotional traits, are only present in a very small minority of kids with conduct disorder, and in our case, adolescents in the juvenile justice system. So when you have public policies that are attempting to reduce a risk factor for something like gun violence, they will focus on something very important like peer gun carrying and peer gun use, and how can we reduce that? What our study shows is that the estimate of the effects of peer gun carrying is actually an underestimate for the vast majority of youth in the juvenile justice system, because the overall correlation is a bit skewed by including those with callous and emotional traits. So what's important for public policy or health policy is that we are actually underestimating some of the risk by not taking into account how that may be moderated by callous and emotional traits. The second part to that is that if we adopt a public policy that reduces peer gun carrying or peer gun use, it is not going to be effective for all kids. We will need to do something else for kids with callous and emotional traits.
And what would be the main messages that researchers, clinicians, and other mental health professionals should take away from your work?
Because callous and emotional traits has been identified as an important specifier or an important way of designating a distinct group of kids who are more severe, we need to develop better interventions. What we know right now, and this is also very important, is that children and adolescents with callous and emotional traits and behavior problems do respond to other treatments that are effective, any other mental health treatments that reduce antisocial and conduct problems in children and adolescents, things like multisystemic therapy and functional family therapy. But what's important is these kids often start treatment more severe, and despite the fact that they respond to these treatments, they often end treatment still more severe. So what that tells us is that these kids are not untreatable. They can respond to treatment, but we can do things to enhance these treatments. And so what we and others have been working on is how can we take what we know about callous and emotional traits? How can we take what we know about the cognitive, emotional, personality, and social correlates to these traits? And how can we enhance existing interventions to be more effective for these kids?
And finally, taking a step back from your specific study in order for us to look forward, what are some recommendations that you would have for further research in this area?
So first, we need to continue to study how CU traits helps us understand unique groups of children and adolescents with a psychiatric diagnosis of chronic disorder, and among those that are in the Juvenile Justice Center that are committing criminal acts, whether or not they actually meet criteria for that diagnosis. And as Paul just mentioned, we really need to focus on creating interventions for these youths, including focusing on testing what is effective overall in reducing these children and adolescents' serious chronic problems, but also testing what interventions are the most cost-effective. That's going to be really important. So lastly, following up on what Paul said in terms of public policy, we need to study not only the influence of peers on gun violence, but other variables that may influence risk for future gun violence, and see if those are also modified by the level of CU traits in the teen. So for example, another study that was recently published by Paul and I and our colleagues using the same data set looks at how the greater degree of contact with the juvenile justice system leads to greater risk of offending over time. And we found that this effect was also modified by the level of CU traits, where the harmful effects of the contact with the juvenile justice system were much more harmful for kids low on CU traits and much less harmful for kids high on CU traits. So again, as Paul, you know, mentioned earlier, what this means is that if you look just at overall at the whole sample, you underestimate the harmful effects of juvenile justice contact for the majority of kids who don't show these high levels of CU traits. And so studying other variables that may be modified by CU traits is going to be really important for future research in this area.
Ms. Emily Robertson and Dr. Paul Frick, co-authors of an article in our September issue on how callous unemotional traits measured after an adolescent's first arrest predict gun carrying and gun use. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
This concludes this episode of AJP Audio. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. Please also visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, to check out trending articles, find CME courses, and watch videos highlighting some of our other articles. APA Publishing has other podcasts you can listen to. Psychiatry Unbound is the books podcast from APA Publishing. It's hosted by Dr. Laura Roberts, editor-in-chief of APA Books. Also check out From Pages to Practice, which reviews the latest research published in the journal Psychiatric Services. It's hosted by Dr. Lisa Dixon, editor-in-chief of the journal, along with Dr. Josh Berezin. You can subscribe to these podcasts on Apple, Google, Spotify, or on any of the popular platforms. Next month in AJP Audio, we'll talk with Dr. Richard Summers of the University of Pennsylvania about his research on the prevalence of burnout and depression among North American psychiatrists. We hope you'll join us too. Thank you for listening.